March 1938. Nazi boots echo through the streets of Vienna while stormtroopers pound on the door of Berggasse 19. Inside, an 81-year-old man with a white beard and jaw ravaged by cancer stands in the doorway. His mere presence, this intellectual giant who dared map the dark continents of the human mind, causes the intruders to falter. They grab what cash they can and flee, but not before promising to return. This is Sigmund Freud, and he has perhaps weeks to escape a regime that burns his books and would gladly burn him, too. What follows is one of history's most improbable rescue missions, a desperate race orchestrated by a Welsh doctor, a French princess descended from Napoleon, an American diplomat, and even a conflicted Nazi bureaucrat. Together, they would pull off what became known as Operation Freud, saving not just a man, but an entire way of understanding what it means to be human. Vienna in Freud's time was a city of stark contradictions. Glittering opera houses stood blocks from squalid tenements, and groundbreaking science emerged alongside vicious political street fights. 50 million people from 9 nationalities collided here, creating the ambiguity that allowed revolutionary ideas to flourish. Freud developed theories that scandalized society. Unconscious desires drive us, childhood shapes adult neuroses, and we're insatiable animals barely restrained by civilization's thin veneer. Yet this Vienna harbored something darker. While Freud built his practice, another Austrian struggled in the city's flophouses. Hitler experienced Vienna not as a cosmopolitan marvel, but as a humiliating reminder of his failures, breeding seething resentment of its Jewish population and democratic institutions. These two Viennas, one tolerant and vibrant, the other resentful and authoritarian, would collide with catastrophic force. When Nazi students burned his books in May 1933, Freud responded with dark wit. "What progress we are making! In the Middle Ages, they would have burnt me. Nowadays, they are content with burning my books." The people who would rescue Freud formed an improbable alliance. Ernest Jones, a brilliant but scandal-prone Welsh physician, became Freud's devoted disciple despite being fired from multiple positions. He established psychoanalysis in the English-speaking world, carefully diluting its sexual content for prudish American audiences. Marie Bonaparte, Napoleon's great-grandniece, married to a Greek prince and fabulously wealthy, found in Freud not just a therapist, but an intellectual soulmate. More importantly, she possessed the diplomatic connections and financial resources that would prove crucial when the Nazis came. Anna Freud, Sigmund's youngest daughter, occupied the most complex position. She became her father's closest companion, nurse, and colleague after he served as her analyst for 3 years, an arrangement that would horrify modern ethics boards. When cancer ravaged his jaw in 1923, only Anna mastered managing the uncomfortable prosthesis he needed to eat and speak. William Bullitt, born to Philadelphia wealth, had resigned from the Paris Peace Conference in disgust, predicting the Treaty of Versailles would lead to disaster. As Freud's former patient and Roosevelt's ambassador to France, Bullitt was perfectly positioned to leverage diplomatic pressure on Freud's behalf. Freud dismissed warnings as nonsense, insisting Vienna was safe. Why flee? He had his patients, his ancient artifacts, his perfected routine. He was not mobile enough. This stubbornness baffled friends. Here was a man who understood the unconscious mind better than anyone, yet seemed blind to the gathering storm. Perhaps it was denial, that most human of defense mechanisms. Or perhaps, after 8 decades, he simply couldn't imagine starting over. Austria's independence was an illusion. When Nazis stormed Chancellor Dollfuss's office in July 1934 and shot him, he bled to death over agonizing hours while his assassins refused help. On March 10, 1938, an anonymous caller warned, "Tell the Herr Professor that Hitler is coming tomorrow." 2 days later, German troops crossed the border. Freud wrote in his diary, "Finis Austriae." Vienna erupted in violence. Jewish shop windows shattered. Elderly Jews scrubbed sidewalks with toothbrushes while crowds jeered. The veneer of civilization proved terrifyingly thin. When stormtroopers invaded Freud's apartment, Martha's quick thinking bought temporary reprieve with cash. But the breaking point came March 22nd, when the Gestapo summoned Anna. As SS men drove her away, Freud paced frantically, chain-smoking cigars. He and Martin had obtained barbiturates from Dr. Schur, a final escape if torture began. Those hours during Anna's interrogation were, according to Schur, the worst day. When she returned that evening, Freud abandoned all resistance to fleeing. No intellectual argument mattered compared to his daughter in Gestapo hands. What followed was a masterclass in diplomatic pressure and moral courage. Ernest Jones flew to Vienna through Nazi territory. William Bullitt enlisted President Roosevelt to intervene. Marie Bonaparte shuttled between Vienna and Paris, smuggling documents and covering massive Nazi flight taxes. The most surprising player was Anton Sauerwald, the Nazi bureaucrat assigned to liquidate Freud's assets. After reading Freud's works, he began protecting rather than destroying them. He hid documents about Swiss bank accounts and arranged for the Austrian National Library to preserve Freud's books. Even within totalitarian systems, individual conscience can flicker to life. On June 4, 1938, the Orient Express carried the Freuds toward freedom. Crossing into France at 3:30 a.m., Freud declared with relief, "Now we are free." In Paris, Marie Bonaparte returned smuggled money and Freud's beloved bronze Athena statue. The family departed gradually, Minna first, then Martin with his family, then Mathilde. Freud's four elderly sisters remained behind, unable to secure exit papers. All four would die in Nazi concentration camps. Britain embraced Freud warmly. The Royal Society brought their charter book to his home for signing alongside Newton and Darwin. "Good company," he remarked. H.G. Wells, Salvador Dali, and Virginia Woolf visited. Yet despite recreating his Vienna study at 20 Mayersfield Gardens, Freud observed sadly, "Everything is here again, except me." Cancer advanced relentlessly. By September 1939, with Britain at war and his pain unbearable, Freud reminded his doctor of their agreement. Dr. Schur administered morphine. On September 23rd, Freud died, not in a concentration camp, but in freedom. His ashes were placed in a Greek vase, a final gift from Marie Bonaparte. W.A. Auden wrote that Freud became no more a person now, but a whole climate of opinion. That climate persists. Anna Freud spent 43 more years at Mayersfield Gardens, pioneering child psychoanalysis. Ernest Jones devoted his 70s to writing Freud's definitive biography. Marie Bonaparte quietly rescued nearly 200 more Jews without seeking recognition. Freud's rescue offers enduring lessons. Civilization's protections can vanish overnight. Bureaucratic evil operates through ordinary people making ordinary choices. Yet individual courage makes the difference. A Welsh doctor flying into Nazi territory, a princess leveraging royal connections, a conflicted bureaucrat hiding documents, a daughter facing Gestapo interrogation without breaking. Today, as authoritarianism tests democratic institutions and refugees flee persecution, Freud's rescue reminds us that the answer to barbarism lies in specific choices. The phone call made, the document hitting, the border crossed, the hand extended. The coalition that saved Freud proved that courage isn't the absence of fear, but action despite it, and that sometimes saving one life means preserving the ideas that help us understand what makes us human.